Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today's special guest is Sherman Boshamgear. Sherman is author of the best-selling book, Token Economy, How Web3 Reinvented the Internet. She's also founder of Token Kitchen and Blockchain Hub Berlin. Previously, she's director of crypto economics at the Vienna University of Economics. Sherman is an Austrian with Iranian roots, and she currently lives in Portugal and works on the intersection of technology, arts, agriculture, and social science. So Sherman, very delighted to have you on Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Very excited to be on your show.
Good. Well, you have a really interesting intersection going on there. Technology, arts, agriculture, and social science.
Yeah. Well, agriculture is the last in the list. We just bought a farm in Portugal. This is why I came here. And it was more affordable to buy a piece of land and do something here. So what I want to do now here is to apply my knowledge on Web3 and tokenization and to do some data-driven farming, work on some new tokenized revenue streams, alternative revenue streams for farmers, such as, you know, proof of CO2 capture, where they can then sell CO2 tokens on CO2 markets, or proof of sustainability, proof of biodiversity. So yeah, so this is something, agriculture is something I'm only just starting, but the other things I've actually done for a while, yeah. But, you know, it might seem quite eclectic, but in the end, the dots connect over the years, and yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, agriculture is such an important part of the sustainable agenda, so to bring your blockchain and technology skills to it is a future for sure. So yeah. Good work.
Thank you.
So do you want to tell me first how you kind of got into this space before we dive into kind of Web3 and things?
Yeah.
What engaged you? What kind of drew you into this kind of technological space?
Well, you know, I initially, before I went into film and arts, I initially studied business administration with a focus on IT and did my dissertation there then on IT systems. And so technology was always something that was interesting for me. But then, you know, I was kind of fed up with this whole. Back then, I thought I didn't like economics and business, what I studied. Now I know that I didn't like the type of economics that was taught to us back in the 90s when I studied business and economics. And because economics is a man-made thing, and mm-hmm. the political aspects behind kind of what type of economics we create, this is man-made. It's not natural given, but I didn't understand it back then. Went into the arts and tried to do something more meaningful, only to understand that the arts were also very market-driven.
Yes.
And the same rules applied to surviving as an artist. And then one thing led to another. I kept following a white rabbit. And I think, I went to Berlin. This is when the loop closed. I worked on eventually after a few years in the film and arts, I got a job offer, or not a job offer. I started a startup actually with some people in Berlin, which tried to have an indie art house film platform empowering the independent filmmakers, but that was before we knew about blockchain. So everything we wanted to do back then was basically not possible in the Web 2. Mm-hmm. And that was maybe 2008, 2009, fast forward. Then I was doing a bunch of other things. on the intersection, like doing my art and making money otherwise, right? And at around maybe 2015, somebody at a party, a friend of a friend, said something blockchain. I'm like, what's blockchain? Then it was like late and we had a lot of drinks, and but like something resonated with me. So the next day I wake up in the morning, I'm like, what was the thing he was talking about? And I'm like, the only thing I remembered, so how do you remember the word blockchain, right? It's like a completely random word that you don't remember when you hear it at first. And then I was like, okay, wait, he said something technology, Bitcoin. And I started Googling, and I just remember lying in bed all day in front of my mobile phone, trying to soak up everything. Mm-hmm. So something instantly resonated with me. And even though I was far from understanding what Bitcoin is, what blockchain is, I had this gut feeling from the bits and pieces of information that I was picking up here and there. And mind you, it was 2014, 15. Like, there was literally no information out there. Like, mm-hmm. I really had to, especially there was like, except for GitHub repositories and maybe some social media channels for where the developers were speaking to each other, but that was the developer speak. But there was no information for normal people. So as I was trying to figure out what this thing is, I was sharing that information. This is how Blockchain Hub started, first as like an educational website and then as a think tank, and then everything, you know, went on from there. But I just really remember that I had this gut feeling that it's an operating system where we could potentially change a lot of the economic and social dynamics that we have in our world. But I didn't understand how and why. And as I was figuring it out, I started, you know, to share this information. And this is eventually how the book was created over the years. Mm-hmm. And here I am. And so, I really think that this new generation internet, like the Web3 blockchain networks, are really the backbone of this new generation or internet that many refer to as the Web3. And the tokens are kind of the killer application. And but to understand this, it took me a few years. And, yeah. And I think one of the most interesting, and this is what got me into it, back then, like, really blockchain networks are collectively maintained infrastructures. And mm-hmm. this is the most exciting phenomenon, that through this very highly criticized mechanism, proof of work, actually what it achieved to do is to create an incentive mechanism for individual participants to be rewarded for maintaining a public payment network in the absence of banks and other intermediaries. And that concept can now be used for creating any other kind of public infrastructure, public computing networks, public telecommunication networks, public social media networks, right? Yeah. But the mechanism of incentivizing has to be through sophisticated token incentives. And the design will depend on the purpose of the network. And we refer to these networks often as DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. And this mm-hmm. is what I think is the most exciting potential of this Web3, if we get it right.
Yes, yeah. We'll dive a bit deeper into getting it right. I was very interested. A few years back, I was reading about TAZ, Temporary Autonomous Zones. I don't know if you've ever read Hackenbey's work.
No, I didn't actually, but it sounds interesting.
It's really interesting, because the minute I saw DAOs, I thought TAZ. It's like, because it was like TAZ is like DAOs without the technology. So mm-hmm. he was very interested in decentralized kind of autonomous zones where people didn't have to go through intermediaries, like voting systems for to explore power. It's very much about kind of participative kind of organizing. And DAOs offer this huge potential, don't they? There's a huge potential in organizing our businesses, our finance, even kind of voting and political systems very, very differently.
Yeah, but I think the important word here is potential.
Yeah.
Because really the Web3, the smart contract-based technology and the possibilities to use tokens as incentive mechanisms to steer kind of the action of people in a kind of a common network with a common goal. It really depends how we design these token systems based on what political philosophy we design these token systems. For example, and I want to get very practical very fast. Like if you have, and unfortunately many of the early DAO or most really of the DAO incentive systems, they create some kind of fungible token, a token that has money-like values that where each unit is identical. It can be used as a currency in the network, right? And it doesn't expire. It doesn't have an expiration date and anything. So it works just like analog money as we know it. But tokens are, you know, programmable money. You can give them any types of properties. You can make them disappear after a while. You can make them. And why would that be important? Because we know that capitalism, the problem is not free market system. Free market is a good thing. The problem is once people start hoarding money, those who have more can make more because money doesn't expire, right? And then we have these horrible power structures where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And then every once in a while we have war and revolution and redistribute the whole thing. And then it starts from scratch. Why? Because the way we define money as a fungible token that never expires is flawed. And unfortunately, I'm seeing that in the Web3, instead of people understanding alternative monetary systems, they take the same principles of money and they apply them to the Web3. And now we have early Web3 cool infrastructure with cool purposes and ideas, but based on outdated principles. Unfortunately, I'm already seeing how things are going wrong because they still build on the principle. For example, this is one example only of hoarding money and kind of a currency instead of making it perishable after a while, and thereby creating an incentive mechanism of, you know, having more productivity and not holding on to your money, but rather doing something productive or redistributing it. This would create a completely different economic system, right? So what we're already seeing, the Web3 with its kind of a base layer technological infrastructure, really it's a governance technology, but how we then decide to create these new decentralized distributed systems on top, you know, this distributed financial systems, distributed social media systems, the way we create it really then depends on us.
Yes.
And very often I have to say that I doubt, like in theory, it can create more possibility for participation, but people have to be willing and have the time to participate as well. And what is often forgot when in the design of these DAOs is they based on the assumptions is very often a bunch of engineers come, they have no social science experience, and they think just because they introduce a voting system where everybody can vote means that everybody will vote. But then in theory, the participation level is only 5% because most of the token holders, investors, they don't have time. They don't have time to think about it, to think about the implications of what they're voting for. And then there is this system that intends to be democratic, completely ignoring everything that we've learned from the history of political science, you know, because they don't include political scientists when they design these systems. So this is one of the biggest challenges, for example, that I see. It's like, again, we have tech people creating tech as if it were tech, not understanding that it's an infrastructure for people, and the people with their different know-hows need to participate in the creation of the tech. Just because you know how to write the code doesn't mean that you know how to meaningfully write the code.
Sure, so that's very helpful for you saying that.
So this is one of, I think, and so yes, it could be more democratic, but the reality as we're seeing it, it's not, because we're seeing the same power structures emerge and the same participation lacks that we have in our current societies, because they're inherent to the dynamics of social systems.
Yeah, no, that replicates a lot of, I have colleagues who consult to DAOs and work in crypto, and they say it is exactly what you've just said, that that the algorithm and biases are dysfunctional because the way they're set up without meaningful thought, the way kind of people are not understanding people dynamics, they expect it just the tech to take over, and yet they haven't kind of thought about the the consequences of some of that. So that's very helpful. What excites you about this this technology, the Web3? What's keeping you excited?
Well, I mean, honestly, the more I know about it, the more I am scared. What excited me initially, because the more I know about it, and the more as time progresses and the more I see how people use it, I see that the Web3 is like a knife, right? Mm-hmm. You can use it for cooking, but it can be used to harm people physically as well, right? And it's the same thing for the Web3. So what got me initially excited was exactly what I said before, the potential. It's like, I think one of the first things I wrote, or back then it was an academic paper I wrote on the Web3, was about the potential of DAOs, distributed or decentralized autonomous organizations, as a new organizational form on top of the internet that transcends nation states and doesn't need the same level of legal trust layer that we need in the world today to interact with each other. And so this is what got me exciting most. And I still think that these DAOs are the next level. From an international relations perspective, they're the next level of a non-state actor in the context of international relations, right? So we're seeing that the boundaries of the power structures, global power structures of nation states are fading since the emergence of the first multinational corporations, first early 20th century, then with an emergence of this kind of the new type of corporations that were internet operated in the Web 1 and 2. And now we have like Web 3 based DAOs emerging that handle a lot of money, their own economies, they issue their own currencies, they all of a sudden have, they're often organized, legally organized as some kind of foundation, and they always have research and development funds to contribute to the research and development of this distributed like organization that has a specific purpose, whether it's peer-to-peer data sharing or peer-to-peer whatever it is, social media or peer-to-peer payment networks. And so this organizational aspect, this institutional aspect is actually the thing that I thought most interesting, and the fact that anyone can create their own currency. Now, the question is, who will participate in your currency system, right? Yeah. How do you make people participate in your own currency? But everything we've always dreamed about, or like alternative currencies are not a new phenomenon, right? So we've had people dabble around alternative currencies, local currencies for centuries, if not longer. But now we have this technology where you can create your own alternative currency with a few lines of code. Mm-hmm. And you can do kind of the concept of local currencies on a global scale. It's local, but not local geographically local, it's local to an idea, mm-hmm. right? Around an idea. And I think these kind of what I call purpose-driven tokens that are issued around, you know, a proof of some contribution to some public goal, whether it's CO2 capture or peer-to-peer payment network, I think this is what fascinates me most. How can we create alternative economic systems? On top of this, and this is what I'm also trying, not as a DAO yet, but at least the alternative value creation for For farmers is what we're trying to do at this farm here in Portugal. Trying to understand how current farming works, like the current incentive systems for a farmer are like you produce some crop or livestock and then you sell it and you want to profit maximize on that, right? So yeah. The current incentive systems are not always geared towards sustainability, right? Often you use fertilizers monoculture, agricultural practices that in the long term very often damage not only your local ecological system, but like when we sum it up, our global ecological system, right? Yeah. So the question here for us now is how can we use tokenization to reward farmers to do the right thing? The right thing from my perspective, okay, would be incentivize farmers to give farmers additional revenue streams when they prove that they produced their agricultural their agricultural practices are can provide or can contribute to CO2 capture, biodiversity maintenance, water retention, soil quality. And these proofs today, some of these proofs already have a value. For example, CO2 capture has a value. And we're seeing that some of the CO2, voluntary CO2 markets, so I'm not sure if you're into CO2 or your audience is into CO2. So because of the global treaties that we've had world over the last 20 years, like the Paris Agreement, nation states have to fulfill their quotas capturing CO2, for example. And then you have the mandatory markets and you have voluntary markets. Now, an interesting thing that is happening is that the voluntary CO2 markets, they see that CO2 only is one aspect, because you can't, there is a bias on CO2. It's very interrelated also to biodiversity maintenance. Mm-hmm. When you have the higher your biodiversity, scientific data shows, and it varies across obviously geographies, but it shows that with biodiversity loss, you have CO2 capture loss. So yeah. If you can prove biodiversity maintenance, this is one of the new indicators that is being currently developed for CO2 standards to also be rewarded, right? So, and we want to take this to the next level and tokenize it using sensor technology on the intersection of blockchain, AI, and IoT. How can we apply this on farms and create tokenized alternative revenue streams based on alternative value creation that transcends this capitalistic input-output idea?
That's so interesting. I'm picking up from what you're saying that really with it's almost like the technological revolution going on is going much faster than the social and the economic minds that follow it. And then the real work to be done is to try and do the work in the political, the social and the economic area to try and shape this or try and keep up or shape the direction of the technology. Would you agree with that kind of way of thinking?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, I think, yes, the technological evolution and the applications that are building on top of it, this is so fast that I can't keep up. Like yeah. I'm having a hard time, and I'm like, this is my full-time job to stay up to date. And I'm having a hard time to stay up to date to be able to write what I'm currently doing, the third edition of the book, Token Economy. So I don't want to know how hard it must be for outsiders who are not specialized in this system to keep up with that. I think it will get easier once the Web3 and their tokenized applications become more mainstream. It's still very niche. People are too much focusing on the currency applications, like the global cryptocurrency applications or crypto asset applications. But that most people are not talking about the recently a bit about the NFTs and DeFi, but it's really like the most interesting use cases we're not even talking about, like what we're trying to do. And this was inspired what Rebalance Earth is doing with the forest elephants in Liberia. Really, we copied their idea, a kind of on the bio elephant tokens or biodiversity tokens they want to create. And so we're seeing that on a general level, yes, people, there is a lag, but on the forefront, a lot is happening, but I wouldn't be as pessimistic. At the same time, we have all these other social movements like Fridays for Future, and adjacent movements that really they're like where people are highly criticizing the political and economic systems that we have now. And I think that all these movements are now coming together. Mm-hmm. And I think we should also talk much more about the intersection of technologies, because tokenization of real world assets or what happens in the real world is only possible if we capture it with sensor technology and have blockchain wallets connected to a tree. Otherwise, so the intersection of, and then we need data, you know, analysis of, you know, so of what happens, for example, the data that the sensors collect in the countryside on the farm need to be analyzed by machine learning AI algorithms. So it's the intersection of blockchain, AI, and IoT that is interesting, paired with the social and economic movements that we're seeing. And I'm positive that there is a potential that all these movements come together, the technological possibilities and the movements as they come together. I think there might be an exponential development of new economic applications. But at the same time, the old system is fighting back with tooth and nails, implicitly and explicitly. So we're also seeing that. So I think the next few years will be very interesting. We're already seeing it. Like, I don't know. And it's like, I can only think about like what's happening with Russia and the Ukraine. There is this old man living, you know, with his outdated principles and mm-hmm. his entourage. I mean, it's not only that old man,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
who thinks that it's a good thing what they're doing. Like, just be innovative, you know, create an app, you know, that saves people's lives based on precision medicine that uses AI. Try to be competitive like that. Why send bombs? This is such an outdated system, and but we're seeing that there is a certain generation that still thinks that these old tools of ego, whatever that is, it's necessary, and we're at this verge, I think, potentially at this verge of social verge of, you know, the old world and the new world potentially.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a space kind of I'm working with the Ecology Institute a lot and trying to work in that kind of emerging space and drawing on social movements. Would you see when you think about kind of Occupy, you think about the Arab Spring, you think about how Web 2 technologies were kind of very important to drive those movements. Would there be applications in Web 3 which would kind of change the way social movements organize themselves? Have you thought about that at all?
Yes, but I have another thought. It's like, remember how Arab Spring, we had all these videos mm-hmm. about what's going on? Mm-hmm. On Tahrir Square.
Yes, yes.
Why are we not seeing any videos on what's happening in Russia or in, like, where are these videos in my feed? This is a question I'm asking myself. Who is censoring what? You know?
Yeah.
This is if we remember any of the prior kind of bigger political events, up until maybe 2-3 years ago, it was like we had in our social media feeds so many videos of citizen journalists recording something that happens and it's being shared. But where are these videos? I don't see them on Twitter. I don't see them on LinkedIn. I've left some like Facebook, the Facebook world, but every once in a while, I don't see that. So I'm wondering what happened to the Web 2? is this filters? Is this censoring? So, and yes, we will have, and we already have the first social media, like Web3 based social media networks. One of the first, if not the first, was Steemit. I have a whole chapter in my book analyzing Steemit. Unfortunately, the purpose was amazing. The token design was so flawed that they, like the economic system they created wasn't sustainable. It didn't work out. I think they still exist, but so we're seeing the first social media networks in the Web3, but we're not there yet. Because we haven't figured out, the community hasn't figured out the appropriate incentive mechanisms that are appropriate to incentivizing a social network to have high quality. How do you curate high quality and reward high quality information, like content? And what's high quality? Because what might be interesting for you is complete trash to me, and vice versa. So we're not yet there yet. Definitely the Web3 could resolve some of the curation issues that we have and some of the reward issues that we have, because it will be much more transparent, because right now the question I'm asking myself is like, why am I not seeing videos of what's happening in the Ukraine anymore? Nobody can answer it, because the algorithms are proprietary to Facebook, Twitter, and all the social media. In Web3 based social media applications such as Steemit, the protocol, the rule set, the algorithms are open source. So everybody knows what the rules are. They're not hidden. You know, there's no hidden agenda. No, yeah. And I think that would be the chance of Web3 based social media networks. But then again, we have a new can of worms of privacy issues. If we don't use privacy preserving, current state of the art blockchain networks are actually not very privacy preserving, right? They're pseudonymous rather than anonymous. So we need more sophisticated application of cryptographic tools applied to these core blockchain networks. And it's possible. The question is, will they become mainstream, right? Other than that, there should be more transparency about like what the algorithm is feeding me. We have no idea. It's like we keep criticizing Russia for a very good reason, and maybe also that a lot of censorship is happening there. But honestly, do we know who is censoring our data feeds or how the data feeds are getting tweaked over at Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, LinkedIn? We don't know, and they're not transparent with their information. They don't reveal it.
No, and this is the big challenge with the kind of Web2, that it became so centralized, the data controls that we just don't know, and we don't know what happens to our data. We don't know kind of what's being privatized, what's kind of being stopped. It's a huge challenge.
Yeah,
like you say, the Web3 opens up possibilities, but there's a lot of work to do to get it right. And I'm really, really glad that you and others are doing the work, because for people like me, it's very hard to keep up.
I hear you. I hear you. And I think this is where exactly the rhetoric or the decentralization rhetoric doesn't hold. So. Yes. And by the way, I don't like the word decentralized anyway. I think these blockchain networks and other Web3 networks are publicly, collectively maintained, internet infrastructure.
Yeah.
But the level of decentralization depends on the power structures. And pretending that there are no power structures, pretending that basic democracy works. It hasn't worked in the real life. How should it work in an information load internet world? Yeah. You know, yeah. Like we moved from, you know, full participation where every citizen can decide on every law to representative democracy for a good reason, because there is a cognitive overload, and in participating in all the decisions, ignoring, apart from the fact that citizens might not have the know-how to participate in some of the complex decision-making process. But then we have the representatives, and the representatives is exactly what, you know, blockchain or Bitcoin wanted to get rid of, the middlemen. But I understand why, you know, the idea, but we need to understand that we can, there is only a certain degree of computational constitution that is possible, unless we have super AI that is super on a superhuman level or a transhuman level. But unless we don't have AI-based governance that has been stress tested and performs in the interest of us, right? Of like the collective of humans, we need a certain level of human governance. Algorithmic governance, such as the blockchain protocols and other Web3 protocols, can help us reduce the friction of coordination over the internet, can create more transparency, can reduce the level of corruption, but it will not reduce human interaction as a whole. We will need a human, you know, there is the algorithmic governance, and then there is this feedback loop where we need to, you know, the human modification part of the algorithm, like the algorithmic governance, it's like the computational constitution of our decentralized networks. It's written in code, in machine code that self-enforces rather than on paper, in legal speak. But it does the same thing. And I think smart contracts should follow, or should go hand in hand with the legal principles that we've developed over the years, right?
Yeah.
We've developed them for a reason, especially in better functioning democratic countries. But then every once in a while, we need to think, you know, the members of a DAO need to think, okay, do the kind of rules that we've defined in the protocol still reflect kind of what we need to achieve, given the conditions that have emerged? And if not, how do we need to update the rule set? And this is something that cannot be outsourced to computers, because otherwise we follow the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. And this is like when you have the fundamentalists vis-a-vis the, you know, progressive people, the fundamentalists, whether it was with the Bible or with the legal codex, they stick to the letter of the Bible. They stick to the letter of the law. And then you have like the progressive people who try to interpret the Bible or the Quran or whatever in the context of now versus then, right? And you have the same thing in the legal sphere. You have lawyers that love the letter of the law. Of course, it's easier. It's like what they wrote. But yeah, that was 200 years ago or 400 years ago. So maybe we should redefine this, right? And this is where you see, and Twitter is really interesting, when you capture some of these discussions, these very emotional Twitter feuds between self-proclaimed crypto anarchists, you're like, that's not anarchy, you know, this is so emotional, you know, and this is like, this is like with such an fundamentalistic spirit of an idea of what is right and wrong. And no wonder you want to put everything in code, because you don't have any tolerance towards like, how do you say, diversity of opinions, you know?
Sure,
and if that stresses you so much, obviously you want to create a smart contract that will enforce everything and there is no corruption, but then we will have, you know, do we want that?
Yeah. Now, I'm really pleased to hear you share this, because, you know, I've been part of anarchist movements, watching feminist collectives, environmentalist collectives, social movements, being an activist all my life. These ideas of being leaderless and utopian ideas, they don't work without technology, and they're not going to work with technology. It's really about trying to improve on what we have, but learning.
But you know where it might work?
Go ahead.
In the metaverse. In your VR world, this is where it will work. This is where you can create probably your own, you know, with your virtual reality goggles. Or in the future, this is maybe where these super idealistic worlds might work.
I disagree.
You think that it won't even work there? That's interesting. That would make an interesting, probably movie or series.
We should make a TV film about it, because I think power dynamics, unconscious dynamics, I think that, you know, it's part of who we are, and we have to kind of live with these tensions, work through these tensions. And even in the metaverse, I think it's just another field to play the same game in.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But if it's the metaverse, some kind of artificial reality where you can, but maybe even if in the artificial reality, you can't create artificial conditions of people obeying to your rules. That would be an interesting social experiment, or you know, experiment once the metaverse is more advanced. These virtual worlds are more advanced. But yeah. Yes, I fully agree with you. You know, all the human conflict and human nature conflict that we have, there is also a human technology conflict, and the human conflict or human nature conflict also persists using technological tools. They can only provide the tools that to reduce certain types of friction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then they always also open a can of worm of new types of friction. And this is what we need to keep in mind, you know. Every new technology brings new opportunities, but also new threats.
Yeah. No, I think it's right. And you know, and we shouldn't underestimate the new technologies and what opportunities and what threats, because every industrial revolution, every huge economic kind of transfer creates new kind of empires, new power games, new possibilities, new democracies, new, you know, there's great gains and there's great losses in both. So, it's really helpful to hear you share that. We're coming to the end of the podcast. It's been fabulous talking with you. I ask guests at the end of my podcast if they've got anything to say to the audience around what it means to live a good life and create the good society from their experience, their work.
Oh, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know. I'm asking myself the same question. Sometimes I think a good life would be not to work so much, but then mm-hmm. I'm like, I want to figure this out. I want to figure this Web3 out, and how can we use it for the betterment of society? But then I'm exhausted and I'm like, I don't have to work so much. I could like enjoy my life more, but then maybe I would feel guilty or empty because I've already had that. So I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. But every once in a while, I see a white rabbit and I follow it. And usually when I do, interesting things come out, but it might be a myth. I don't know. Maybe other people realized this way earlier than I did, but I needed almost 50 years to realize that life is not easy, you know, but maybe it's not, because it has its ups and downs, but it's usually it's after the fact, then you remember, like, that was a really good time. I didn't realize it at the moment because I was exhausted, or maybe I was expecting to do things faster. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know what, maybe to answer your question from my perspective, because I haven't achieved it yet, a little bit more patience. I think patience could increase the quality of one's life, because I seriously lack patience, and I try to do too many things at the same time, and I'm very often overwhelmed by it, and maybe patience and moving slower could increase the quality of life.
Thank you, Sherman, for sharing so much. And I'd like to recommend your book to everybody. If you're trying to understand what's going on in Web3, then Sherman's book, Token Economy, is a really great explanator. So thanks for your contribution. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. Take care.
Thank you so much. It was a wonderful interview.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Coming up, we have our next advanced coach program. We now have 400 coaches trained internationally. If you're a coach, a leader, or a consultant wishing to develop your coaching skills, come to this advanced program. It's online for 12 weeks, and I'll be leading that program. Our community of practice will be meeting on September the 13th. We have a webinar with the First Nations Worldviews being presented by Michelle McMahon.